Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Rates and Lanes with Rico Mohammed. This is the show where we improve your knowledge of the freight market, improve your bottom line, and improve the transportation industry as a whole. We're talking Rates and Lanes. Let's move on down the audio road.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Rates and Lanes podcast with your host, Rico Mohammed. I'm waiting to hear from Chuck. I haven't heard from him as of yet, but Chuck Snow should be joining us here shortly. And, of course, tonight is legal night. We have our resident legal expert on board with us, Mr. Hank Seaton. So if you have any questions surrounding any type of transportation issues, whether it be contract disputes, any legal advice, anything like that we may be able to help you out with, you can press the number one that puts you in the call screener queue, and we'll get to your question as soon as we possibly can. So tonight, we want to take advantage and make sure that, you know, if you got a question, it's a great time to go ahead and be pressing number one, get in the call queue early and often, and we'll try to make sure that we incorporate you into the show. Moving right along, jumping over real quickly into this week's USDA fruit and vegetable report. The movement on the report has, it is quite, things have kind of died down. Everything has kind of settled in comparison to last week. There was a lot of movement, and this is a different story this week. So we don't have any areas around the country that are reporting any type of shortages or any slight shortages for that matter. However, we do have two areas that are reporting slight surpluses this week. And those areas that are reporting those surpluses are South District, California, and Central and South Florida. Those two areas are the areas that are reporting slight surpluses of trucks this week. Moving right along, let me jump over into this week's DAT Trendlines report. And bad weather across a large swath of the country stalled the momentum that had been building on the spot market that continued to a downturn in the national average for vans and reefers. Volumes are still on par with last year, but capacity has been more plentiful in 2019. Flooding the road closures should lead to higher flatbed demand. So with that being said, we have no changes in the fuel prices for this week, showing a national average of $3.08 per gallon for diesel prices. And taking a deeper dive, and we're going to go try to break down segments on the spot market for dry vans, that is. And this week, starting out in the northeastern portion of the United States, we have outbound spot market dry van reports coming out of the city of Philadelphia at $1.71 on the spot market. We have, excuse me for a second, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, moving down into the southeast, we have Atlanta, Georgia being the representative city, showing $1.84 per mile on the spot market. Moving up into the Midwest, we have Chicago, Illinois checking in, showing an average spot market rate of $2.15. Coming out of the south central portion of the United States, Dallas, Texas check in, showing an average outbound spot market rate at $1.76 per mile. And coming out of the City of Angels, Los Angeles, California, we have an average spot market rate of $1.75 per mile. Moving over, jumping into flatbeds, we have coming out of the northeastern portion of the United States showing an average spot market rate of $2.35 per mile. Moving down into the southeastern portion, we have an outbound spot market rate for flatbeds at $2.41. Moving up into the Midwest, Rock Island, Illinois, showing an average outbound spot market rate of $2.67. Coming out of Houston, Texas, we have an average outbound spot market rate for flatbeds at 211. And coming out of the West Coast, showing an average spot market rate of $2 per mile coming out of the West Coast. And moving on, jumping over into the refrigerator portion of the report from DHT, showing an outbound spot market rate in the northeastern portion of the United States out of Elizabeth, New Jersey, $2.02 per mile. Moving down to the southeastern portion of the United States, showing an outbound spot market rate of $2.05 per mile. Moving up into the Midwest, leading the nation, showing an average outbound spot market rate of $2.57. Moving to the South Central, we have an outbound spot market rate of $2.20 per mile. Wrapping up, coming out of the West Coast, showing an average spot market rate at $2.11 per mile. And one more report here, if I can get it to pull up. We'll check to see how the bad broker report, if we have any new entrants on that report. While I'm trying to pull that really quickly. If I can get my... Okay. So we only have good news, one new entrant on the report, and that is Rapid Trans Freight LLC. That DOT number for Rapid Trans Freight LLC is 320-6726. As of 3/12/19, this is an updated credit alert. Their MC number is 100-0282. FMCSA shows that the surety bond is set to cancel on 4/7/19. They have over $38,000 and non-payment complaints that have been reported. That's a quick and easy bad broker report. And with that being said, let's see. I think that this is our co-host, Chuck Snow. Chuck, is that you right there?
You got him, Rico. How are you?
Cool. I am doing well. How about yourself?
Everything's good up here in Canada. Spring is finally here. I was getting worried.
Well, yeah, just listening to the weatherman. Spring sprung down here probably about 30 minutes ago. I didn't know that they had it right down to the hour. But according to the weatherman here, we just got into spring about 30 minutes ago. So,
well, congratulations.
Spring has sprung. Hopefully the weather will spring on up as far as the temperatures are concerned. Because I tell you, it's down south, you know, we don't really care for the cold weather all that much. And man, the last couple of days, temperatures have really plummeted. And it's starting to warm back up. But it has been tough sledding down here as far as the temperature is concerned.
Well, and that doesn't, you know, you're giving the DAT report, and that certainly doesn't help grow things when you have those cold temperatures. Nothing's growing. As a matter of fact, when I was in Florida recently, the people who I was visiting, they had greenhouses in the Apopka area, and they were growing tropical plants, and they had to turn their heat on, which is something they, you know, even in the winter, in January and February, they very seldom do. And this was in March already. So, you know, it's been one of those years, and that's affected this. Some of this adverse weather has certainly affected the freight outcome on the perishables. So it's, you know, I heard you say that there was a surplus of trucks in Florida. That's pretty uncommon for this time of year. Usually, you know, we're into just past the middle of March. Things are rocking and rolling out of there. There's usually all sorts of freight out of there, but it doesn't seem to be happening quite as quickly this year. And I'm sure it's weather related.
Absolutely. And with that being said, we don't want to keep our special guest of honor for tonight standing by. We got Mr. Hank Seaton that is joining us this evening. Good evening, Hank. How are you?
Doing fine. How are you, Rico?
We are doing well. Well, before the show came on, Hank, I had a question that I was kind of putting to you, some advice that you might be able to lend lend to someone. Got this scenario, says, I'll leave the name of the company nameless, but it says that a broker called my driver at 1 a.m., woke him up, telling him to drive illegally to deliver a load in Stockton before noon. Truck was loaded at 4 p.m. in Yuma, Arizona, and we gave them an ETA of 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. the next day. They called dispatch and harassing, if load is not delivered before 12 p.m., they will put a claim on the claim on the whole load. It's a total of 670 miles plus deadhead miles for pickup, loading time, and scale time. How would you advise someone that has this kind of scenario been placed on them?
Well, there are several issues. The first issue, you're required to make delivery only with reasonable dispatch. We don't know what type of product is on this. You know, it may be meat with a shelf life or something. But in any event, it's very clear that the appointment time that was given to them and was agreed to was reasonable dispatch. Ordinarily, they say that a truck ought to make about 500 miles in 24 hours. But in any event, you can't get special or consequential damages for not making that kind of transit time. The important thing here is there are what they call coercion rules, and they're written in kind of a strange way to protect the brokers. They're written that the broker can put all the pressure he wants on the dispatch to get it delivered without it being technically coercion, but the broker cannot call the driver and insist that the driver break the hours of service or the speed limit to get a load delivered. There are strict penalties for that, up to $10,000 per violation. At that point, any broker who does that has got some tall explaining to do. If, for instance, a driver was coerced to do that and either was involved in an accident for speeding or got an accident for driving over the hours, that would be a straight pipe opportunity to get to the plaintiff's bar to get the broker involved in the lawsuit. Moreover, it's a violation to call a driver when he's sleeping. You know, you can always say, well, hell, I didn't know. But, you're supposed to have 10 hours of uninterrupted off-duty time. So for a number of reasons, that practice is not to be encouraged. And if the driver wanted to push it, he could push for the fine. And I think there are even civil penalties for that. It's just really a no-no. While I say it's against the law, I think we all know that what's going on, particularly in the foodstuff industry, with the penalties for non-delivery, and we don't tell the supplier we don't want it unless it gets here on time, is putting that kind of pressure on the supply chain, and I think you're going to see more and more of it. The idea of macro point and things like that, being installed on the truck that leads a broker to have to micromanage the truck is all, I think, pushing the supply chain to the breaking point. But that's enough. I hope I answered the question and probably provided more information than the person needed.
Absolutely.
Great answer, Hank.
Since we have well, Chuck, I was gonna put you on the hot seat next, since you're a broker and a carrier. How would you handle such a situation?
Which hat you want me to wear, Rico? My broker hat or my carrier hat?
Well, we'll go from the carrier standpoint from right now, because we.
I would remind the broker, because we have brokers loading some of our company trucks. And I would remind the broker of the law and remind him of the precedent set by one of the very large brokerage houses. I'm not going to mention names on the show, but they're probably the largest. And I think that they were the original case where a couple of their young dispatchers, this tired truck driver to drive when she really couldn't. She didn't have enough juice, and she got into a serious crash, and they got fined, or they, I don't know about the fine, but they were certainly punished by having to pay a huge settlement to whoever got hurt or died or whatever. So I would just remind them of that. On a carrier end, we do make calls, but we know the law, and we work with our carriers. It's really important. We understand. And communication, from our point, is the key on brokerage. You need to find out when you load that load. Okay, the driver's leaving at 4 o'clock, and he's got 5 hours left in his book or her book, and they're going to shut down at 9 p.m. The dispatcher knows that. And they know not to bother that driver from 9 until 7 so they can get that 10 hours of uninterrupted. At 7 o'clock, you can call them or their dispatcher to make sure they're rolling. But you don't interrupt a driver's sleep. That doesn't get you anywhere. And you certainly don't coerce a driver into breaking the law. You know, that can't happen because, as Hank said, the consequences are just too severe.
Yeah, well, what Chuck mentioned is a very notable case, and it's where a broker tries to exercise too much control over a carrier, and particularly when that exercise of control is implicit in the very accident itself. You know, in the case he's talking about, not only was it illegal, it subjected the broker to a huge, huge settlement. Plainest bar's dream.
And I think that there's some talking about as far as we may take it for granted, but I think we have new listeners coming on board all the time. And, you know, this is part of the reason why, if you have a trucking company, there's nothing saying that you can't have a brokerage as well, but they normally, you have to have, those are two different entities. It can be owned, you can own both of them, but that's two different entities. And, can you explain the reason why that practice is, Hank? Can you break that down for us?
Yeah, and it's a subject of a lot of real confusion. When MAP 21 came out, OIDA wanted to address the problem of double brokerage and the fact that carriers weren't getting paid. The old rule was really pretty simple. There was a thing called convenience interlining. And Crescent Carriers, if it accepted a shipment, could take it to Atlanta and give it to somebody else, or it could hire another authorized carrier to go and pick it up at origin and deliver it at destination. Because a carrier could act like a freight forwarder and name itself on the bill of lading. By the time the TIA got through with the legislation to deal with double brokerage, they had put in there that a reputable carrier who wanted to outsource his freight not only had to have a bond, he had to have a broker's license or a freight forwarder's permit, and he had to identify to all parties that he was acting as a freight forwarder or a property broker when he was otherwise convenience interlining. Well, since he had to have, since the FMCSA wouldn't issue distinct numbers, and since a lot of small carriers wanted to gloss over the fact hiring somebody else to pick up the shipment, they were just putting their broker authority in the same name as their carrier, which led to great kind of confusion and liability. It's something that I advise large carriers particularly against. You don't want your name on the bill of lading as a carrier,
and then have some small carrier have an accident and plaintiff's bar come after you because you're the carrier named on the bill of lading. So the best practices and the one that the insurance companies, the smart ones, required was, okay, when you're going to outsource the freight, set up a brokerage in a separate corporation so that you can draw a very distinct line between when you're acting as a carrier and have responsibility for the safe operation of the commercial motor vehicle, and when you are an arranger of transportation, just hiring someone else who's got those burdens. So that leads to the kind of crazy thing in which you can be Excel transportation and Excel brokerage, and you need to use Excel brokerage to contract for the outsourced freight that really is a convenience interline. So it's confusing, and it creates – go ahead, Rico.
Well, I was going to say I've heard tales of stories that if you try to pull off a brokerage and a trucking company all under the one umbrella, that your insurance company would more than likely cancel your insurance.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, look, the insurance companies I work with say we will write contingent broker insurance if your brokerage is in a separate company. But we don't want to have to put the traffic manager for your trucking firm on the stand to defend a broker case. Because what plaintiff's bar does is they come in for these guys who've got carrier and broker in the same name and say, I'm going to take the deposition of the safety director for the carrier. And then they start asking him, well, would you have hired this guy as an owner-operator? Would he have made your standards? Well, if he wouldn't have made your standards, why in the world did you broker a load to him? And you can see where it ends up. It ends up putting on trial the broker's ability to just hire a carrier and rely on the fact that the feds checked him out. And, I've seen plaintiff's bar try to confuse whether or not the subcontracted carrier is his own licensed, authorized, and insured carrier, or whether he's an owner-operator, and trying to explain to laymen what the difference is and why it is that the carrier is responsible for the safe operation of the owner-operator but not responsible for the safe operation of the separate carrier when it looks pretty much the same, is something that confuses a jury very quickly.
Well, good enough, Hank. I wanted to – it's been a little while since we talked, and I kind of wanted to circle back. I wanted to get that question out there in particular, but I wanted to circle back around because it's been a little while since we've had you on, and we know that you kind of are the man that has his ear to the streets up in Washington, D.C., and the latest that is going on. Can you tell us any of the latest happenings or anything that we need to be aware of that may be coming out of Washington,
well,
D.C.?
Well, I think everybody knows that Washington is even more dysfunctional than it's ever been. Now that the Democrats are in charge of the House, there is a rumor that the Democrats are, particularly since DeFazio is the chair of the committee, are going to try to take a run at increasing insurance limits for carriers again. And we will definitely oppose that. You may remember there was an outfit called the Alliance, which is a group of large carriers that said it's unfair that they can be held liable and have to pay a $10 million judgment when a small carrier doesn't have that much insurance and just simply goes out of business. I think that argument was thoroughly trashed. We filed comments in it when the agency tried to do it, and they abandoned it on the idea that small carriers just very simply couldn't get $3, $4, $5 million. And moreover, the real dirty little secret is that the private carrier doesn't have to; it may not even have state law minimums. So it's a bad idea. I don't know who's actually pushing it. You would think that certainly OIDA would be against it. Every small carrier would be against it. And I really don't see how a big carrier can support it because they're so dependent upon on small carriers for power only and excess capacity. It just seems to me to be one bad idea. But that's about the only new thing on the legislative front. We've still got this whole issue of the fact that SMS scores were taken down. Plaintiff's bar and FMCSA still try to justify it, to use it. It's still hanging around, and it's hanging around in the form of a pivot to something called the IRT, or the interim response theory, which the guy who is touting it for the agency says is mathematical magic. They say it's kind of like the SAT. The only difference is everybody takes the SAT on the same questions, and everybody takes the whole test. And when you apply this to trucking, they admit that there's a dearth of questions asked, i.e. incidents for small carriers, and that there is a real problem with data integrity. And the data integrity thing shows up in the geographical anomalies, the enforcement anomalies, the just bad luck of being in the wrong time in the wrong place. All of that's been presented before, but the agency is still pretty daggone stubborn about it, although the new administration has been a little kinder to us. They haven't derailed the idea of bringing back SMS scores. I think I mentioned before, under the IRT, they would start looking at things like method of pay, amount of pay, driver turnover, maybe even the time of day that you're operating the truck, a whole bunch of more data that would just play hell for the industry. I'll tell one more interesting consequence. They are behind the scenes running this new thing in a test, and some of the larger carriers are buying the data to see how it would track out. And one guy I know has 1,400 trucks, and he had a perfect score the first month in alcohol and drugs, and the second month, these 1,400 truck operations had the worst score you could get. It's kind of like the SAT, but an 800 is you ain't gonna get out of grade school. So anyway, he got an 800 the second month, and you say, what did he do? Well, one of those 1,400 truck drivers driving a sleeper cab had an unopened six pack of beer in the sleeper cab. Now, you know, if that kind of anomaly can happen to some dude who's got government contracts and running 1,400 trucks, think what it could do to Crescent carriers.
Right.
So, you know, we could be in for an interesting ride on that.
Someone sent me a text message, Hank. I don't know if you might be able to handle this one or not, but I'm going to throw it at you anyway. They were saying that, let's see here, there was a recent bill that was passed that gave reciprocal rights for field weapons across state lines. What's your advice on if you have a concealed weapon permit in your state, having one in your commercial vehicle?
I'm going to pass on that one. I'm going to pass on that because I frankly don't know. When I was a young lawyer and was doing what they call CJA work, which was going down and representing people who had gotten arrested in the District of Columbia, the first case I handled was one in which a Baltimore businessman was riding around the Capitol. This is before we had any any terrorist or anything. But anyway, they stopped him and asked if they could see his driver's license, and he flipped open his glove compartment and out fell a handgun. And they had him locked up under the jail in D.C. And you know, he was protesting that, you know, he was legal to carry it in Maryland just over the county line, but D.C. wasn't listening to it. So you know, after that experience, I'd have to see the statute. The other thing that people are asking me that has a little bit to do about that is, are the feds going to come after you for hauling marijuana if it's being sold legally in the, if you're transporting it from California to New York and they stop you in Kansas because it's, you know, still illegal in interstate. And I think that's another interesting question that has been raised to which I don't have an answer. It all gets down to this question that is going to be addressed, and people need to understand it's called federal preemption. And it is the doctrine that, when does the federal law trump the state law? Now, most people in the Southeast particularly have this kind of don't tread on me attitude, and they don't want the federal government telling them what to do. But that comes back to haunt you if you're in the trucking business, because now you've got to operate in California under rules that frustrate commerce. So do you let the feds decide when federal preemption is played and when it doesn't? That's kind of like the California situation with I call it the bald-headed scalp. You know, the feds came out and said the California meal and rest break violates federal preemption, and now they've been sued by California and the Teamsters and everybody else. Well, the idea of federal law allowing truckers to go between all points in 48 states without having 48 different laws makes good sense. But depending upon your political persuasion, if the Commissar of Transportation can make one rule in the Trump administration and then we get Bernie Sanders in, you may find out that you don't want the federal government having all that power. So, you know, that's the real issue, and it transcends trucking, although trucking is really the home of it because it's called the Commerce Clause, and that's where we really decided that we didn't want to have, 50 separate laws in 50 separate states. But, Bubba, we got it. You got what you have to do for workman's comp in Georgia is completely different from Tennessee or North Carolina, and they're all basically adjacent states.
Absolutely. I just want to take a quick time out to remind our listeners to press number one. If you got a question for either myself, Hank, or Chuck, you can press number one. That'll get you in the call screener queue. We know to come to you, and we'll get you up and on board so that you can ask your question if you have one. Chuck, and I don't want to hog the conversation. Did you have anything that you wanted to get in tonight?
Well, I find it's really interesting. Hank brought up a great point with the hauling marijuana. Where does that stand? And we're having not quite the same, because the feds in Canada they've legalized it, but nothing. The distribution of it wasn't solidified, nor were the legalities. Well, the legalities, you're not supposed to operate a motor vehicle under the influence, but the methods that the police are able to use, and they admit themselves, are questionable. And when before the law was passed, there were criminal lawyers in Canada saying, I can't wait till somebody gets busted. Give us a call if you get caught for impaired. We want to challenge this law. So this is, we are in uncharted territory. I think Canada being, you know, one-tenth your size, I think we jumped on the bandwagon a lot quicker federally than our U.S. counterparts did. You're behind it, but I would think somewhere within the next 2 years it will be legalized. But I hope to God they put laws into effect to, you know, just to cover everything, because you may have, what may happen is you may have a federal statute, and Hank, correct me if I'm wrong, you could have a federal statute that says that marijuana is legal, but you could have it prohibited in certain states, couldn't you?
Well, see, the way it goes, the use of marijuana will be governed by state law. So, for example, California may have recreational use, and New York may only have medicinal use. So the states get to, at this point, determine what laws apply to marijuana. The last person that asked me the question, I gave them this analysis. I said, first of all, I don't know, and I don't. But you look at it this way, marijuana is a lesser drug when you start talking about Oxycontin and those kinds of things, but how Oxycontin is prescribed and used is governed by state law. But, you know, very clearly, you've got to be able to transport prescription drugs. You've got to be able to transport explosives. Alcohol, tobacco, and firearms regulates a lot of that, but not with the idea that they make impossible interstate commerce of the transporting of controlled substances that are legitimately used. I mean, you know, you got rules against bootlegging untaxed whiskey, but one way or another, you know, you may have to get an alcohol permit in some state, but Jack Daniels can ship its whiskey to any legal distillery or distributor in any state that authorizes the sale of it. And, you know, there may be some federal or state taxes in it, but there's certainly not a prohibition. So I don't see how, if you're selling marijuana, you could have federal strictures on it any more than the selling of any other barbiturate or opioid that moves between Purdue out of New Jersey and wherever it goes to be sold by Walgreens.
Right. Good point.
Well, we got a listener that has a question. We're going to go and try to grab them and let them get in on the conversation. Caller from area code 612. You're up live with Rico, Hank, and Chuck. How can we help?
Good evening, gentlemen. Name is Corey, and I have a question.
Good
perfect
evening,
to have all three of you on tonight. Let me give you a little background. I live currently in Minnesota, have an LLC in Minnesota, active and in good standing. Last fall, I had my interstate authority. I canceled the insurance and put it on pause for the simple fact to get through the divorce and all that fun stuff.
Right.
This spring here, within the next month or two, I am relocating down to Georgia. So that's in your neck of the woods there, Rico. And I'm wondering,
yes,
I'm assuming, I haven't called FMCSA, I'm not positive, but when I reactivate, I'm assuming it's going to consider me a new authority again. And I guess I'm wondering, would it be just easier to, rather than trying to transfer the LLC to Georgia, to just start new with a new authority, new LLC down there, or not?
I think there are a couple of considerations. First of all, I think you can. I think you can certainly double clutch it. I think you can probably reactivate your authority if it hasn't been dormant for long, and then you can reincorporate and change your business address to Georgia. Particularly, you know, if you didn't quit business with some kind of safety cloud over your head, because they're very concerned about people buying dormant authority to escape safety. But you know, if
no,
if,
I have a spotless record. There's nothing there
on
my record.
Then, yeah, the other thing is the fact that you get it reactivated will keep you with an older docket number that may give you a little more clout than starting originally. Obviously, getting the new authority and starting over is not a difficult task at this point. You know,
right.
It's going to take you about the same amount of time. You'll get the new carrier entrant, and it'll be welcome to Georgia. The other thing is, when you if you do file for new authority, you in theory are supposed to identify on the form that you know you're the former owner of the LLC that ceased. So one way or another, there should be tracking you. If you do decide that you just want to reactivate the other, my office can help you in anything. It might be a little cheaper.
That was my question. If you still had your that other, I can't remember the website now, but I've listened to you guys for a long time. I got your books, Hank, and I know Rico's down in the Atlanta area. So that was my concern, was what I was worried about the LLC. If I moved, if it would be considered like a foreign LLC and might hinder me some way, would be just easier to open a new business down there.
You're going to the corporate deal. You know, you're probably going to need to, say it. The agency used to have, and they've screwed it all up. They used to have a thing called a change your name or business form, and you just go in and say in there, you know, I'm Hank Seaton. I'm the owner of Seaton LLC, a Minnesota corporation. I want to reactivate that LLC and move it to Georgia, and you know, they would let you do that, as a change of name, because there was no change in ownership or control. But you did have to.
Yeah, the LLC is still active and in good standing. I mean, I just renewed it in December. I stopped my insurance policy in, I want to say, October of last year. So the authority, you know, that just went dormant then because the insurance stopped. So, I mean, it's not
Corey, I want to interject here for a second. One experience that I've had recently, we started a new branch in Chicago, Illinois, and we got new authority for it because we needed a separate set of authority, separate from the Canadian. And,
sure.
You know, I've been in this business altogether for, you know, 45 years, and I've had traffics going for 40 now. And I had one heck of a time getting insurance as a new startup. So if I can give you any advice, and I'm not a lawyer, Hank is, if you can continue somehow with that same LLC in Georgia and just move it down there and go and talk to your insurance provider and convince them that you're still the same good old operator that Corey was prior to putting everything on hold, you may be able to dodge a huge bullet, because I can tell you there is one insurance company in your entire country that will insure anybody pretty much to start with.
Yeah.
And that is, and I'll say it on the show, maybe they'll get some business out of it, although they don't deserve it. But there's a reason for their rates, and that's Prudential. And they will charge you a minimum of $24,000 per truck. For $1 million coverage.
Chuck, I think you mean Progressive.
Yeah,
you're right. Yes, it is Progressive.
Yeah,
thank you for
Chuck is right on. The biggest game going now is to try to find, for newbies, to try to find insurance. If you've been around and you have got a record, even if you've had a cessation, you know, you're talking about $10,000 or $15,000 a unit different. And the problem with the monopoly that this one company has is they do know underwriting, and one strike and you're out. I mean by
right.
that, they may write you, but then they will cancel you in a New York minute, and when they do, then there's really blood in the water because you got 30 days to find somebody else.
Well, that was my question.
And good luck on
that
one.
Insurance. Like I said, I just stopped it in October. You know, I have proof of loss showing no proof of loss, you know, and had no incidents with them. You know, I mean, I was only paying $8,000 a year for my insurance, everything, commercial and cargo and all that. So with one truck and trailer, you know, so I just didn't know with the pause in the insurance, would I be considered still new in their eyes?
That's up to interpretation by the insurance company. If you have a good agent, since it's been about 6 months, you may be right on the cusp of the insurance company. And we've had two insurance experts on the show. Hank brought on an insurance expert recently, and he was phenomenal. We had another one on before that, and both of them said the same thing, that there's an insurance crunch on because the insurance companies have been losing a fortune. They've been losing it went from 10 cents on the dollar back in October to when Hank brought on a guest, which is probably about 6 or 7 weeks ago, they were up to 12 cents on the dollar. So the bleeding hasn't stopped. And part of the bleeding is because, and Hank, no offense to your noble profession, but there are some out there that are, you know, there are ambulance chasers out there that have done, and we see their signs on billboards across, right across North America now.
Sure, it's the demonization of the trucking industry. And what happens is, you got to realize this: if somebody stumps his toe, the plaintiff's bar is going to try to tell the jury if they can find that the driver was halfway negligent. You need to send a message to big truckers. Then after the defense bar gets through playing with it for 2 years and running up the insurance company's cost, then before trial, the carrier has to come to the insurance company, the motor carrier has to come to the insurance company and say, now look, I've only got $1 million worth of insurance, but you know, if this jury goes crazy, you're either going to have to offer up the $1 million or take the risk of non-persuasion. And at that point, that a lot of these insurance companies are so worried about a rogue jury that they'll pay $1 million for something that a reasonable man would say is you're fine, go back to work. So that's why these runaway jury verdicts just have the insurance companies becoming a nation of sheep. There was a insurance seminar on the other day in which all of the insurance gurus were saying, well, you better go look at CSA scores, not because they're a predictor of safety or they're going to tell you a damn thing about the fitness of the carrier, but because if your guy's got bad scores and does have an accident, plaintiff's bar is going to wear you out.
Right.
So, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's not that it deems you a bad actor. It's that somehow plaintiff will allege that the broker should have known he had an accident and name the broker, and then you got to indemnify him, and it all becomes a merry chase. That's why we've got to have some kind of tort reform down here. And my friend Chuck in Canada doesn't begin to know how bad it really is.
Oh, I do. I'm playing in your pond now. I do.
Well,
I have a really good idea.
but you in Canada, you really don't have those runaway verdicts. You haven't had any $40 million verdicts.
Yeah, I heard that, and I will say this in public, I heard that Werner got, you know, there was some case. Werner, it was in the hundreds of millions of dollars somewhere. It's insane. All they're doing is delivering free.
It's interesting. Werner is a very good company, and ultimately the Werner driver had pulled off the road in a snowstorm and was hit by the four-wheeler. And ultimately, they said that the Werner driver, I think, pulled off. I think he was either a newbie or wasn't familiar in driving in snow, something like that. And the take home was that he was at the wrong time in the wrong place and Werner paid.
Yeah,
I mean, that makes no sense whatsoever.
Corey, we appreciate the phone call. We got about 10 minutes left in the show, and we're talking about insurance. I'm not sure, but there was an insurance company that went out of business or something to that effect, Spirit Commercial Auto Risk Retention Group. On February 27th, Department Judicial District Court of Nevada entered a permanent injunction order appointing commissioners as permanent receivers of Spirit Commercial Auto Risk and Retention Group and receivers permanently out of order. Are you familiar with that one, Hank?
No, I'm not. They certainly weren't a substantial underwriter. When you talk about a risk retention group and you talk about a state overtaking it, I am familiar with that. One thing that carriers try to do to avoid the insurance prices is they form risk retention groups or SICs, or under state law, there are ways for carriers to set up minimums and act as insurance companies. And for sophisticated larger carriers, when there's not adverse selection, it makes good sense. There are people like Cottingham and Butler that set those things together, and you'll find that carriers that have 100 or more trucks may very well be in a risk retention group. When one gets mismanaged or turns upside down, then the state has to take it over and manage it and send out premiums and basically liquidate it. Now, the fact that, you know, just that risk retention group is in the name probably means that it didn't have broad effect on small carriers, and there may have been 50 or 100 guys that were a member of it. We had that happen in Tennessee when it was a risk retention group to try to cut down on workman's comp premiums, and they let in one carrier who had very bad workman's comp experience. There wasn't enough money to go around, so the state took it over, and it became a real fiasco. But I don't really think that that's something that probably affected the market that most of the listeners are involved in.
And closing us out tonight, the group that you made us aware of before, Hank, Black Smoke Matters, they seem to be having another, trying to get another bite of the apple. They're trying to do another shutdown. It says
all I know about that group is what I see on the website. I have a flyer here.
It says April 12th, 2019 until trucker shutdown. Here's a couple of the bullet points. Hours of service reform allowing flexibility across the trucking industry to support many different sectors. Bullet point number two, electronic logging device, ELD, to be made a choice under the American Constitution, right? Bullet point number three, provide training safety standards for all new incoming CMV drivers and all four-wheel motorists at the time of obtaining a new or one-time license renewal who share the roadways with CMVs. Bullet point four, truck parking availability, security, and necessities, food, restrooms, showers, et cetera, as citizens are provided. Number five, FMCSA regulations and inspection training standards for officers. Inspections to eliminate self-interpretation, which can lead to false negative inspectors and unwanted violations. And final bullet point, panel of truck drivers included in decision for all proposals of new or modified regulations prior to approval and implementation. This is kind of, I guess this is part of their platform and things that they are trying to request as part of this shutdown from April 12th, 2019 until. Yeah, that's interesting.
I don't know who sent me the link to it, but I went on the website and saw that they had some really pretty radical kinds of statements, and you know, I can sense the frustration, but you know, I don't know who these are and how they came up with the name and what they're about. I guess I'm concerned that the last thing we need to do is to be too strident. You know, I think we've got common sense on our side, and I just hope we do it in a dignified manner. I guess those of us who've been out here lobbying for small carriers for a long time get frustrated when we don't get heard, and when we think that we have the better part of an argument. But I'm certainly not promoting a truck shutdown.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Hank, we got about 5 minutes left in the show. You want to maybe give us some closing remarks?
Yeah, one thing I wanted to ask Chuck. Somebody is asking on a seminar I'm doing Monday whether or not Canada's HOS requirements will mirror the U.S. and the ELD requirements. What's going on in Canada in terms of HOS and the ELD?
Well, the ELD is coming, and I believe that's coming next year in 2020, if I'm not mistaken. Hours of service is a little bit different. We are allowed 14 hours driving, on-duty driving. I don't believe you have to take a break. You can go right through.
Okay, so that means you can easily get 750 miles in a driving period.
It's really hard. You know, remember, this is Canada. So where you don't have multi-lane highways, and you've only got you've got a few cities that have multi-lane highways, being Toronto, Montreal. Mm-hmm. You have Vancouver, Calgary, and Edmonton. Those are the busy cities. Anywhere around those cities or between them, you know, on the outskirts, you're not going to get 750 miles because the traffic congestion is so deplorable. So other than that, you're on a two-lane goat path. Even though, like, our national highway, our Trans-Canada Highway, for the most part, is a two-lane road. It does break into four lanes and it's around big cities or larger towns, and we do have passing lanes, but an awful lot of it, because you know, we're a small country and it's embarrassing, you know, the road network we have. So it's pretty hard to get 750 miles in a day. You could, but my God, it's not easy. You know, you wouldn't be taking a break for coffee or fuel.
Yeah. One thing I would suggest, as a friendly advice, is that strict enforcement of an ELD limits productivity and doesn't have a damn thing to do with fatigue. And sooner or later, we're going to learn that down here, because the ELD has hurt productivity, and crashes are up. And when you want to try to figure out why crashes are up, it's because now people don't have any freedom, and are just having to speed for the very reasons that was brought up earlier in the question about making a timely delivery. The demands for timely deliveries, strict enforcement of the ELDs, forces people to speed, either to get home for the weekend or to get that 6 a.m. delivery made. And those are unintended consequences. I think it's time that we really look at measuring fatigue. Hell, we talk about all kinds of technology that's going to replace the driver. You ought to at least, first of all, think about giving him a heads up on whether or not he's fatigued.
Yeah, great, I agree.
Point.
Very good
I
point.
I wanted to, next, and that's something that I want to bring up as well. I want to kind of go back over this whole autonomous driver situation. But we are wrapping up tonight. We are completely... I was just completely flown by. I want to thank you guys for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us. I want to thank you, Hank, for taking time to come on and answer some questions and help educate our audience. We definitely appreciate it and want to just thank you guys. Want to tell you, tell a friend to tell a friend about the podcast. We're still working on trying to get the YouTube up and running. Hopefully, I wanted to try to have it going this week, but I didn't want to have a dry run and try to do it while we were on the air. So I'm going to try to continue working on that and try to get it perfected, hopefully sometime over this week, and maybe try to do a trial run before next week's podcast. And that way we will definitely hopefully have all of the kinks and everything worked out on that. So with that being said, Chuck, you want to tell the good people how they can get in contact with you? This is not being recorded, I don't think. I think we're in overtime now.
Okay, 800-388-4352. You got to press 203 and you'll get me, or you can email me chucktraffix.com, or you can catch me on Instagram, Chuck Snow CEO. If you're going down to Louisville next week to Matt's, come on and see me. I'm right next to the Pittsburgh Power booth. Come over, say hello. I'd love to meet our listeners. It's always an honor. If I can help anybody out there, come on and see me or give me a call.
Sounds like a plan. Well, God bless you. Good night. Be safe out there, everybody. And God willing, keep it in between the mustard and the maize until next week. This is Rico Muhammad signing off for Chuck Snow and Hank Seaton. God bless you and good night, everybody.
Catch you on the flip-flop.